This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
One of the most popular guests we have on Dreamland is Andrew Collins. Andrew Collins is a researcher of the First Order into our deep and lost past. In 2009, Anne and I met Andrew at Avebury, a wonderful, eerie place that we'll talk about a little bit today, but our primary focus is going to be on incredible discoveries at Göbekli Tepe. And in May, Andrew is going to go to take a tour to Göbekli Tepe. So go to Andrew Collins' website if you are interested in possibly going there with him. It's simple. It's andrewcollins.com. And you will find information about the Turkey tour. I mean, can you imagine personally going to Göbekli Tepe and seeing it with somebody who knows as much as Andrew Collins does about this and so many other things? Andrew, welcome to Dreamland.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back.
Well, good. Yeah, you've always been a popular guest. People love your delivery, but above all, it's your knowledge that they love. And let's get right into it. And I want to start with something that we talked about a few years ago that also became a meditation on unknowncountry.com that subscribers can find in the subscriber section under Whitley's Room. It's one of the most powerful, according to the comments that I've gotten about it, meditations in the whole section. And there's a lot of powerful meditations there. This meditation involves the star Cygnus, at Cygnus X3 in particular. And I want you to start out by telling us how you found out about this remarkable thing, what it is, and where you are with this discovery now.
Well, Cygnus X3 is either a black hole or a neutron star. It could be something even more exotic than that, maybe even what they call a quark star, which I won't even try and go into what that might be. But essentially, the important thing about it is that it has this most incredible jet of plasma and energy and electromagnetic particles that's directed towards our own solar system. In other words, it's almost like we're looking down a long gun barrel, basically, towards this particular star that's spewing out all these energies and particles on different levels. And we register them here on Earth in various different frequencies, on X-ray and infrared, in gamma rays, and also in cosmic rays. In the 1980s, a number of particle detection facilities that were either deep down inside mines or within the center of mountains in different places of the world, so deep away from the outside environment for the very reason that they needed to shut out any kind of cosmic rays affecting the experiment, suddenly found that over a period of 4.8 hours, every day they would get these cycles of cosmic rays that would be hitting the detectors. And at first, you know, this was obviously something that was an annoyance to them because they thought they'd shut everything out. But they worked out that the only particular stellar object in the night sky that had that cycle was Cygnus X3. So these particles were so strong that they were coming directly all the way from Cygnus, and the distance of this particular star is about 26,000 light years away, and that they were penetrating through our atmosphere directly without interacting with the atoms of oxygen and nitrogen and hitting the ground and penetrating that for a depth of 200 to 300 meters or more down to the depths of these facilities. Now, no other type of cosmic ray, you know, other than a few odd stray ones here and there, is able to do this. Now, neutrinos are known to pass through the Earth, but they don't affect anything. They don't affect, cellular life in any way. But the cosmic rays from Cygnus X3 could easily be affecting us and affecting our evolution. in a very, very subtle way. I mean, obviously, the way that we evolve as creatures, you know, within the universe as itself, is because of mutations in DNA, and those mutations can come about in a number of different fashions. Either they can come through our diet, our environment, electromagnetic interference and anomalies, you know, at certain locations, but also through cosmic rays. And this is something that even Carl Sagan suggested back in the 1970s, that human evolution may well have been affected and evolved through the presence of cosmic rays that come in and mutate or delete or open up DNA sequences.
So what happens then exactly is that the cosmic rays strike cells and
it's even on a deeper level than that. The DNA, the very building blocks of cellular life, and obviously our cells, the things that create fingers or ears or whatever, are affected in this way. But we must not look at this simply as a physical thing, because quite clearly it's affecting the brain as well. And the brain will therefore evolve. Our consciousness will be upgraded, will change, depending upon deletions and mutations of DNA actually inside the brain matter itself. And I think this is important. And I think that what's also key here is the fact that the ancients may well have been aware of this source that's affecting life on Earth. Because deep down in caves, where obviously cave art has been created since as early as maybe 30, 40,000 years ago, you know, our ancestors would have been down in these dark, gloomy places for probably quite prolonged periods of time, maybe days. And they would probably have been doing rituals, going into altered states of consciousness, you know, hallucinogens may have been involved. And suddenly, they may see a flash of light in front of their face. They wouldn't have known that this could have been a cosmic ray passing through either the optic nerve or even through the viscous part of the eyes, which is something which we now know occurs and can create flashes of light. So they would have seen these flashes of light, and they would have seen them perhaps as some kind of religious experience, or certainly triggering off a religious experience or some kind of download of information. And very quickly, they would have realized that these flashes of light occurred most frequently when the stars of the Cygnus constellation were directly overhead, because it is a fact that these cosmic rays from Cygnus X3 rise and fall in accordance with the position of Cygnus in the sky. So probably within a few generations, they would have worked out that there was something important about this constellation. And this would have been heightened by the fact that Cygnus, which is the celestial bird, the swan in Eurasian and in some Native American traditions, was directly placed on the Milky Way, where the Milky Way breaks into two separate branches, between which is what's known as the Dark Rift, or the Cygnus Rift. And this is an area in line with the galactic plane of dust and debris that causes this very dark area. And it's very prominent in the sky if you can see the Milky Way, you know, on a fine night. And this spot, this opening in the area of Cygnus where the Dark Rift begins, has been seen by our ancestors for many, many thousands of years, possibly as far back as the Upper Paleolithic period, as some kind of entrance into the sky world or the upper world, or what Christians might call heaven. And that Cygnus, because of this, became to be associated with the source of life itself, the place where souls would come from before incarnation, and that they would return to this same location in death. And that very often the vehicle that would carry the souls between one world and the other was a bird. And that bird would often be reflected in whatever Cygnus was in the particular region in the local star lore, the local mythology, the local legends. And quite obviously, its main form is the swan. And the swan is a primary bird of the soul. Everywhere around the world, it is seen to carry souls not just away from incarnation, but to bring them into incarnation as well. We most obviously see the stork as a bird connected with bringing newborn babies into the world. But it's a fact that in the Baltic countries of Northern Europe and in certain areas of Central Europe, it was the swan that brought newborn babies into the world. Now, although this might conjure an image of some kind of, baby in a sling being held in the beak of these creatures, Originally this would not have been the case. The idea is that the soul comes as a bird, or certainly that the bird brings that soul into manifestation.
You know, this is very, very fascinating because I have a personal experience that's related to it. When we get back, we'll continue talking about this subject. Andrew Collins' website is andrewcollins.com. He's planning some fascinating tours, and later in the show, we're going to get into some additional discussion of Göbekli Tepe in southern Turkey, where a truly mind-bending find has taken place. We'll be right back.
Whitley Strieber is the legendary author of Communion, Transformation, The Grays, Superstorm with Art Bell, and so many more. You can find out more on his author website, Strieber.com. Get his great new Journey to Dog Heaven, his classics, The Wolfen, Transformation, rarities like The Wild, and so many more. Strieber.com. And join Whitley on his Facebook group, Supernatural. Follow him on Twitter, Whitley Strieber, author of Wonder.
You've probably heard the music for years. It's the theme song for Dreamland. But you may not know the name of the piece, The O of Pleasure, or the name of the composer, Ray Lynch. Ray Lynch is a 3-time Billboard Award winner. Ray is also the composer of the platinum album, Deep Breakfast. Pandora calls Ray one of the most influential artists in New Age pop and adult alternative circles. For music that will move your heart and set your spirit soaring, visit www.raylynch.com.
We're talking to Andrew Collins today. Andrew's been on Dreamland many times, and if you're a subscriber, you can go back into the archive and listen to some of these fabulous shows. Last year, we did a program on Göbekli Tepe with Andrew that was just fascinating. And we're going to get back into it because a lot of new stuff has been discovered, and it's mind-bending in any case. But before we go there, let's return to Cygnus the Swan and the bird that is the soul or brings the soul. When did this idea that the soul was a bird first emerge, Andrew?
I think it's been there all the way along, but the first time that we see it in art is probably around 16,000 BC. And this is inside a cave in southern France at a place called Lascaux, because in a deep chamber, there is a particular fresco on a wall that shows, amongst other things, a bison, and next to it is what appears to be like a falling figure with a bird head, which is considered to be a shaman wearing the head of a bird. And just below this this bird shaman is a bird on the end of a pole. Now, a German professor by the name of Michael Rappengluck of Munich University in 1999 identified this scene as representing Cygnus, and the fact that around 16,000 BC through to about 14,000 BC, Cygnus actually was the star group that was closest to the what's called the northern celestial pole. Now, this is the axis that turns the stars around due to the actual, you know, spin of the Earth itself. And so the cosmic axis, the point of exit from this world into some kind of other world, which is something that shamans very strongly believe exists in connection with the pole star, at that time would have been Cygnus. And shamans believe that some kind of sky pole connects this world through the cosmic axis to the sky world itself. And in Siberia, often this is represented by a pole with a bird on top, usually a swan. And this is seen as early as 16,000 BC in this cave at Lascaux in southern France. And this bird almost certainly represents Cygnus in the role of the celestial bird, the soul bird itself, because what the scene probably shows is the shaman entering into an altered state of consciousness and becoming a bird and travelling in this form, in this guise, to enter the sky world or heaven through the Cygnus constellation itself.
Now, what is interesting here, it suggests that some kind of an energy possibly coming from Cygnus is responsible for the soul. Am I right about that, do you think?
It's a difficult one. I mean, you know, this is a philosophical question, obviously, as to, you know, what the soul represents, what the spirit represents, and exactly what form it might exist in before incarnation, and obviously once it departs incarnation. But, of course, if we are makers of our own reality, then quite possibly it is indeed a bird that the soul takes the form of, you know, when it's in some kind of astral or disincarnate state. Now, this may be of human making over a period of you know, let's say at least 18,000 years, possibly even longer, but maybe that's just exactly the way that it is today, and that the bird is dependent upon the regional significance of the soul and its connection with these soul birds, which were in Greek known as psychopomps. Psychopomp is a term that was used for the soul accompanier or the soul carrier, the thing that carried the soul from one world to the next. And it's also obviously the vehicle that the shaman himself or herself uses, you know, to go between worlds from this world to the next. So, you know, as far as Cygnus is concerned, there are various reasons as to why it's so important. Firstly, because it was pole star between about 16,000 and 14,000 BC, it would have been the very star around every around which everything else revolved in the northern night sky. It would have been, but more than this, because it is located on the Milky Way would have pivoted around Cygnus every night, like some kind of weird cosmic propeller, you know, on the end of some massive invisible aircraft in the sky. And every night, once it would have aligned up perfectly north-south along the so-called meridian line that passes overhead. And this is something that has never occurred since the northern celestial pole has left Cygnus. After that, the pole star became Vega in the constellation of Lyra for a short time. And after that, the position remained unoccupied all the way down to the Pyramid Age, when a star called Thuban in the constellation of Draco, the celestial dragon, took over the role for a few hundred years, about the beginning of the Pyramid Age. And, you know, obviously today we have Polaris. And of course, the reason for this movement of the northern celestial pole is precession, the slow wobble of the Earth, over a period of 26,000 years, this one great processional cycle. And of course, this not only shifts the constellations that we see rise at the time of the spring equinox to give us the particular age. Obviously, today we're in the beginning of the age of Aquarius. But going back to the time of Göbekli Tepe, 11,000 years ago, we were in the age of Leo, the lion. And I think that this has a significance in itself as to what was going on in this age, because Göbekli Tepe, created around 9,600 BC, was just after the end of a very terrible period of cataclysm and impacts that had occurred and had devastated, almost destroyed the world for a period of hundreds of years, and that Göbekli Tepe was the product of the world that came in the aftermath of these disasters. So we should never forget that, you know, that there is a connection between the appearance of this megalithic or monumental architecture like Göbekli Tepe and what had preceded its existence, and in the form of this cataclysm that had occurred.
Andrew, we're going to take another quick break here, and then I want to dimensionalize that cataclysm, because what's so interesting here is that Cygnus was prominent in the sky. Some kind of energy was changing us prior to the cataclysm, because this is when the cave at Lascaux that you referred to and the other great cave paintings took place, was some kind of an energy entering mankind that was turning us into a kind of genius. We're going to find out what Andrew thinks about that and exactly the dimensions of this crisis when we get back in just a moment. Subscribers, just keep on. If you're a subscriber and you hear the commercials, you're not logged in. Log in, you won't hear them anymore. It's automatic.
OneUnknownCountry.com subscriber says, "The subscriber offering has blossomed into an indispensable tool for my spiritual growth. Unknown Country has revitalized my sense of awe and wonder. I am very happy to participate in this exciting adventure." Listen to what another one has to say.
"I've been a subscriber to Unknown Country from almost the beginning. I get information there I can get nowhere else on the web."
And think of what you get. Commercial-free access to every Dreamland since 2004. Hundreds of special interviews. The Astonishing Meditations of Whitley Strieber. A small collection of UFO videos, but one that is rock-solid authentic, unlike so much you find elsewhere. Plus, the satisfaction of knowing that you support the best Edge Science website in the world.
Unknown Country, genuinely new, genuinely credible, like nothing else in the world. Subscribe today. We need you. And you'd be surprised. Once you start, you'll realize you need to be a part of this community too. Click on that subscribe tab today.
Whitley Strieber, author of the Alien Hunter series. Gail Ann Hurd, producer of The Walking Dead. Natalie Chaidez, producer of 12 Monkeys. This incredible team has come together to produce Hunters for the Sci-Fi Channel. In April, it starts. The Hunters are coming. Prepare yourself as best you can.
This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking to Andrew Collins, andrewcollins.com. Go with him to Turkey in May. That would be worth doing. You can find out more about it on his website. He's also got a lot of fascinating books out there, including a great one on Göbekli Tepe that we talked about in 2014. And subscribers, you can go and listen to that show and to the other shows we've done with Andrew. Obviously, this is a man of immense knowledge. Okay, so let's now, Andrew, go back to the period right as this crisis occurred. When was it and what happened?
Well, the cataclysm, which we know almost unquestionably occurred in the world, took place around 10,800 BC. This is when it started, at least. It would seem that we are talking about a comet that appeared in the inner solar system. It may have looked as if it had come from the direction of the Pleiades. And that's simply because that's the way that it appeared within our sight, within the night sky. Not that it actually came from the Pleiades itself, but it was first seen in that area. And it came into the inner the solar system and probably went round the sun and probably broke up on the other side of the sun. And that a great many pieces were then sent on a direct trajectory towards the Earth itself. And the people living at this time, which included the Upper Paleolithic cultures, many of them high cultures around the world, including obviously the Clovis people of North America, and obviously, you know, the Magdalenian people of Europe and the Swiderian people of Central and Eastern Europe and many others aside, would have had a rude awakening as they'd have seen these incredible fireballs going through the sky, many of which would have exploded even before impact, causing the most incredible wildfires and damage immediately, destroying the so-called Pleistocene megafauna, you know, things like the saber-toothed tiger, the giant camels, the giant sloth, the mammoth and the mastodon, all these things, all of these animals virtually disappeared overnight. And it's estimated that in North America alone, perhaps as many as 75% of the human population were destroyed. And certainly, shortly afterwards, the Clovis people disappear completely. And with this would have been perhaps the melting of parts of the ice sheets that were up to 2 miles thick in North America and Europe at this time because of pieces of the comet impacting with them. This would have created the most incredible floods rushing southwards and in every direction out from the direction of the ice, carving out landscapes, drowning everything in their path, and sending this cold water into the ocean, which changed the currents and the cycles of the ocean, and plunging the world into a mini ice age that lasted for about 1,200 years, which is known as the Younger Dryas event.
Boy, can you imagine what that would have been like? Because, you know, 1,200 years is such a long time. Most people in that time never knew anything except this chaos.
Exactly.
Incredible. We couldn't have a civilization like we do now under conditions like that. Absolutely not.
You know, and at the tail end of this, when the climate does start warming up very dramatically as well, probably within a generation, and some have even proposed that another cataclysm actually ended this mini ice age, within 100 years of this, Göbekli Tepe is constructed, and it has to be a response to what has just taken place. And what I wrote in Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods, is that it was created as some kind of almost like a sort of primitive form of Stargate, if you like, to project the souls or the spirits of the shaman that were using the site directly into the sky world so that they could deal with the supernatural creatures, you know, like the wolf and the fox and the dog and probably other ones that were seen to be responsible for the appearance of comets in the skies. Because you can imagine that if it was a comet that had caused this cataclysm, every time another one appears in the sky, people are going to be fearful that this is all going to happen again. And it probably in some cases it did happen again, because I don't think that the event of 10,800 BC was in isolation. There were probably other cosmic events taking place over a period of hundreds of years afterwards, possibly right the way through until around 10,300 BC, some estimates suggest. So, you know, this would have been a very fearful time, and they would have needed a way to counteract this. And for them, they didn't have, you know, space science and things like this. They couldn't knock pieces of comets out the way. For them, they had to do it with the mind. They had to do it through magic. They had to do it through shamanism. They had to do it through approaching the supernatural forces that they would have seen as of causing these type of cataclysms, and dealing with them direct, either attacking them or convincing them not to attack or pushing them away, you know, maybe somewhere else or something like this. This is the way that they would have psychologically dealt with this problem, a problem which the visionary writer Barbara Hand Clow referred to as catastrophobia. That was almost like some kind of illness that humanity was suffering at the end of this period of cataclysm. And I think that's an incredible way of looking at it, that people were incredibly fearful that all of this might happen again, and they had to deal with it. So they created monumental architecture like Göbekli Tepe and almost certainly many other sites around the world which we're probably uncovering at this time. Perhaps even Stonehenge in my own country here in England. We now know that the earliest phases of Stonehenge go back probably to 8,000 BC. And I'm sure that very similar dates will emerge to do with many megalithic sites around the world that were all constructed post the Younger Dryas mini ice age.
So it's it was, in other words, a time in which, as Barbara Hand Clow, so I think brilliantly speculated, we ended up in a state of amnesia from it's as if the whole species has genetically encoded into it a level of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Absolutely.
That causes us to simply fail to look at this. Even very intelligent scientists can't look at it.
Yeah.
But we're going to look at it, folks, through the eyes of the people who were there in just a moment. If you are a subscriber to unknowncountry.com, we're now going to Göbekli Tepe and some of the incredible new discoveries that shed a whole different light on this extraordinary period and what happened as mankind slowly, the few who were left, clawed their way out. And I'm going to ask the question, was there so far in the past, so long ago, we have essentially no memory of it at all, something here that was more than just a hunter-gatherer society? Subscribers, just keep listening. Free Dreamlanders, thank you. I urge you to subscribe. This can't go on much longer without you.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by unknowncountry.com and our family of subscribers. Our news editor is Ann Streber. Our science reporter is Linda Moulton Howe. Our webmaster is Daniel Stiegel. And I'm your Dreamland announcer, Brian Arnold. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.